Wednesday, December 13th, 2023, you are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from the Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado, and we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. Hope your week is going well. Hope you, your family, your friends, you're all staying strong and you are all staying healthy right now. And hey, it was another crazy weekend in the world of sports. I mean, think about some of the things that we have seen take place over this past weekend. We saw Shohei Ohtani sign with the Los Angeles Dodgers for $700 million. It seems like a lot of money, doesn't it? We saw LSU quarterback Jaden Daniels win the Heisman by edging out Washington's Michael Penix, which was kind of weird because Daniels pretty much lost every big game that he played in this year. I mean, Florida State, Ole Miss, Alabama, didn't win any of them. Penix, meanwhile, didn't lose a game. The Heisman voters strike again. But, I mean, remember, these are the same people that gave the award to Eric Crouch and Jason White. Now, I mean, I actually do like Daniels. But, come on. Is he really the best player in the country? I doubt it. In fact, I kind of think it might have been that kid at Ohio State. Wide receiver is pretty good. The Los Angeles Lakers won the NBA's first in-season tournament. Whatever that means, I have no idea. But, I mean, I guess LeBron James lovers can say that he won something that Jordan or Magic or Kobe or Bird never won, right? And then on Sunday, we saw Kadarius Toney make a stupid mistake that cost the Kansas City Chiefs a big game against the Buffalo Bills, basically because he had another mental error. I mean, it was a weird weekend in the world of sports. And yet, wait a second. The Dodgers got more talent, spent a ton of money, but will probably lose in the playoffs again. The Heisman voters got it wrong. LeBron won something meaningless in the great scheme of things. And Kadarius Toney is an idiot. You know what? Never mind. It was just a regular old weekend in the world of sports. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, hey, holidays are coming fast. You might need to pick up one more thing for someone on your list. Make sure you stop by DailyDoseSports.com because we have new articles going up every week. In fact, this week we discussed a little bit of how fortunes have changed here in Denver for my hometown Denver Broncos. But we have links to YouTube videos there. We have links to the Daily Dose gear there as well. And if you are still shopping, you need a t-shirt. You need a sweatshirt, you need a hoodie, you can make sure to get a Daily Dose one and pick up exactly what you need for that person on your list. Make sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com every single week and checking in over there. Hey, today on the show, we are going to be joined by a very special guest. And in fact, we have a ton of things to cover today, so we need to jump into that interview right now. Joining us this week on the Daily Dose, we have a very, very special guest that I am really looking forward to speaking with because Ray Hartgen has co-wrote a book called Immaculate, How the Steelers Saved Pittsburgh, which is published by Morgan James Publishing. It is a collection of stories about the Pittsburgh Steelers, and you're going to be interested to hear this story about how he is involved in this. He has also finished another book that is even more personal in nature. I want to talk about that a little bit more here in a few minutes. And he is currently working on yet another book, his third book. Again, another one that I want to discuss. But Ray, thank you so much for joining us today on the Daily Dose.
Hey, Clint, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to chatting to you for a long time, so this is going to be great. Let's have some fun.
Let's do it. And you are interested in a number of things that I am interested in. You love sports history. Like I said, you wrote a book about how the Steelers saved Pittsburgh, and yet I come to find out you're not even a Steelers fan. What in the world? Where did you grow up, first off?
My father was in the Army, and that was back in the days. I'm 59 years old now. I was born in 1964. That was back in the days when the Army moved you around a lot. But my mother is from Texas. So I was born in Houston. And we grew up a lot in Texas when my father went overseas to Vietnam and Korea. And we also were stationed in Fort Hood in Texas. So I grew up quite a bit in Texas. And as a good Texan, back in the day, I was a Dallas Cowboys fan.
Well, sure.
And, the Cowboys very famously lost two Super Bowls to the Steelers. You know, my second favorite team, Clint, was the Houston Oilers because I was a good Texan. And Oilers never could squeeze past the Steelers to win the AFC Central Division.
That's true.
And because of that, they lost two games on the road at Three River Stadium in the playoffs. My third favorite team was my mama's favorite team. My mama's favorite team was the Oakland Raiders because she liked Kenny Stabler, just like everybody else's mama liked Kenny Stabler, right?
Of course, right. Yeah, that's how it works.
And then the Steelers, eliminated them from the playoffs in three, famous playoff games. The Raiders won a couple in that. But, through that all, in the 70s, the Steelers were gum on my shoes.
Well, sure. They ruined your day.
They ruined my days, seasons consistently, and I hated them. I liked to see them fail, which did not happen very often. But, as I grew away from my kind of, my child mentality, everything, lives and breathes by, the results on Sunday afternoon. I began to appreciate, what that Steelers team did, four Super Bowl championships in 6 years. Yeah. The amount of talent that they assembled on those teams and the coaching staff, putting them in the position to be the best players they can. Those defenses were dominant, right? All those great players on defense and then the great players on offense. You just think back to the 1974 draft class. They drafted four Hall of Famers. We have a hard time now. It's a 50-50 on whether a your first round draft pick is still with you 3 years from now, right? So it was really fun to go back and look at all those games. Like I said, as I got older, I began to appreciate and respect the Steelers. And now I cheer for them. I mean, this is a team, I believe it or not, has had three head coaches in over 50 years.
Unbelievable.
They recently fired their offensive coordinator, Matt Canada. Right. That was the first in-season coaching change they had done in over 40 years. And you look at some teams like Carolina Panthers, geez, they've had three coaches in less than three seasons, right?
Sure. Yeah, they do it every year.
Yeah, it's a revolving door. So it was really fun to go back and take a look at those things. And, as you and I, been around watching a lot of football, we know intellectually that the game has changed a lot, but when it kind of sneaks up on you when you don't really, when you go from year to year and week to week, going back onto YouTube and watching some of these great games from the 70s, see how much the game has really changed and, the personalities that played in those games, the personalities that announced those games. Oh, it was so great to listen to Dandy Don Meredith in the booth or something like that. Kurt Gowdy on the play-by-play. Yeah. I mean, that just brought back all these childhood memories. I'm getting a little goosebumps, right now thinking about it. So, it was a lot of fun writing the book.
So you grew up in Texas. You said you cheered for a few different teams. But, and I'm always interested to hear this. Who were your sports heroes growing up? Because a lot of times it might not even be the team you cheered for or whatever, but when you were looking and you're going out in the field, you're going out on a court, whatever you're doing, who are you trying to emulate?
Yeah, in football, it was Roger Staubach, right?
Man, how could it not be?
Guy, and, Drew Pearson, if I had to be on the other end of the path. As a kid, I suited up sometimes the offensive line as well. Rayfield Wright. Then people like on defense, Bob Lilly and Leroy Jordan, Charlie Waters, and Cliff Harris as safeties. But they were also non-Cowboys, Earl Campbell. Everybody liked to see Earl Campbell playing in the football backyard, right? Billy White Shoes Johnson. The Raiders had a whole bunch of guys. But, I don't know if I can ever remember being like the shutdown corner playing like Mel Blunt. But if I could be somebody right now, Mel Blunt would be a pretty good player to be. Right?
Not all bad.
Why
in the world, and this is totally off the subject, why can't we get those Houston Oilers uniforms back? They're the greatest uniforms in the history of the NFL, and they bring them back for 1 week, Everyone loves them. Drives me absolutely crazy. They are gorgeous.
I don't know if you saw earlier this year in college football, the Houston Cougars.
I did.
It's sort of a, you know,
kind of homage. Yeah.
It's slightly different, but the NFL got mad at them. Cease and desist orders, so you can't, you know, the no fun league. You can't have the uniform.
As usual.
Like, man, come on, you abandoned the town. But those are some pretty sweet unis, aren't they? It was kind of cool.
The red mask and they were gorgeous. They were just absolutely perfect. And those Love You Blue teams were really, really fun, really, really good teams. Describe, because it's different now. I mean, when I think how things are now, and I think of how my kids, you know, watch sports or whatever, you know, you turn on, you're watching the Red Zone or whatever. Describe a typical Sunday in your world watching games, because it was the only thing to watch. That was it.
Yeah, it was the only thing to watch. You know, back in the day, these young listeners, and I tried to talk to my son-in-law about this. Our daughter recently got married, and he only watches football Red Zone.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, well, hold on a second, man. You like miss all the nuance of the game. You miss all these great plays that don't, you know, just don't show up in the highlights.
Yeah, scoring plays. Yeah.
Pass or whatever. It's like all these great defensive plays in particular. But, you know, back when we were kids, we had three games, listeners.
We had three games
to watch. We had a couple of regional games in the day, during the day. And then the afternoon game would be the national game. Yeah. Right. So we tended to get, you know, some Cowboys and stuff. But, you know, there was a few years, you know, when I was living in Indianapolis area, you know, our regional broadcast, I meant Bears and Bengals. Those are my two games, you know, during the day. And then the national game, that might be something, you know, like a rivalry game, Cowboys Redskins or something like that. And then, of course, we had Monday night. And some of the biggest parts of Monday night, first of all, if you're in the East Coast, if you can stay up that late, but to catch Howard Cosell at halftime, because he would give like the 3 minutes, like Chris Berman does now.
Yes.
He'd give those highlights real fast. That's the only chance you got.
That was it.
Happened in New England the day before or whatever. You know, you read about it in the newspaper and all that, but watching football, completely different. But now, man, we get all the games. We get games on Thursday. Sometimes we have multiple games on Mondays. It's a different world. But, you know, I started off, you know, living in Texas and was a fan of the Cowboys. As a young man, after college, I moved to Seattle. And, you know, pre-internet, you know, if you can't be with the ones you love, you got to love the one you're with, right?
Sure.
And, you know, in 1990, pre-internet, you know, I just saw the Seahawks in the newspaper every day.
Oh,
I didn't say anything about the Cowboys. So I just naturally became a Seattle Seahawks fan because, you know, they were close by. And, you know, it's great now with the internet. Now you can be a fan of anybody. You can live anywhere. You can live overseas and, you know, and still catch the games, you know, stream the games, you know, get all the news media that you want. But back in our day, Clint, man, different world. And
you couldn't do it.
It was tough to be a fan. I remember subscribing to the Dallas Cowboy a newsletter. And it was like a sporting news type of newspaper.
Like a newspaper.
And, I got it, you know, once a week during the season, once a month in the off season. And that was how I, you know, kept track of my favorite team and all their losses to the Steelers in the Super Bowl.
Well, you know, the roster moves and things like that, you had to have that. I did the exact same thing. And you had to have those. Otherwise, maybe you found out about it in your local newspaper. Maybe you didn't. It wasn't the same. And, you know, you talked about Monday Night Football and what an event that it was. Remember, there was only like four stations total. Everybody was on that one and watching those games. But if Howard Cosell actually talked about your team at halftime, it was a big thing.
It was a huge thing.
Like, and you get mad at him if he talked bad about you. I know here in Denver, everybody hated Cosell because he's always kind of talk about his, the dusty cowtown and that kind of thing. But you tuned in and you watched every second of it. Every Monday night was spent in front of the TV doing homework as a kid. And there is no comparison for that era to us. It just was a completely different thing.
Begging your parents that you could stay up to at least halftime to catch Cosell before they pushed you off to bed. I mean, but the game started, I think, what was it, like 7 Eastern? You know, it'd be...
It was late for East Coast.
Actually, I think it was 8. Yeah, I think it was 8 Eastern.
I think it was.
Yeah, and so, you know, halftime rolling around at 9:45, you know, you're... fifth grader or something like that, and your parents are going, you're way past your bedtime. Like, please, Howard, I gotta know what happened.
It's a close game here. It's Dolphins versus Oilers. I gotta see how this turns out.
Yeah, and forget about staying up at the end of the game. That'd be impossible for a kid. So I live out west now. I live in the Bay Area, And I was just commenting to my wife Monday night. I was watching that game, and it was going a little over. But, you know, I was like, you know, I love living out west. It's 8:30. The game is over. See, and if we wanted to, we could go out to dinner. It'd be like a late dinner.
Right. You know? Oh, yeah. It's interesting because I have family in California. And we go out there. And for games to start on a Sunday at 10 a.m. and to be wrapped up by 9 p.m., it's not all bad. And now I can't complain being in Denver. It's a little late at times. And if we have a, you know, like the NBA or the NHL gets a little more challenging because they'll play West Coast teams and that'll kind of shake things up. But for the most part, it's not too bad in Denver. But yeah, West Coast is a very, very different animal as far as staying up and watching those games. So
hold on a second. Before you ask me a question, I got to have a question for you.
I'm ready for it. What do you
ask me about, you know, who are those, you know, football idols when you were a child? Yep. Who did you look up to? Who were you pretending to be on the playground?
So I was a very, very young Denver Broncos fan. I started following the Broncos before I can truly remember saying I followed the Broncos. But I got my mom to iron on. I had a white sweatshirt. She ironed on 2 4s, and I got to be Floyd Little.
Wow.
And I only got to watch it maybe 2 years. Yeah. And I was little. But Floyd Little, those Charlie Johnson. And then about the time I'm in kindergarten, they start getting good. They start getting, you know, that defense, that orange crust is coming together. You get Craig Morton coming in all of a sudden and actually get to beat the Steelers in the playoffs, which I still to this day might be my favorite game ever.
Really?
That and the Packers game. Obviously, the win over the Raiders just because of what it meant at that time. Bronco fans now have no idea. They just don't understand. They're like, oh, I don't know. We've won Super Bowl. No. We were horrible. Yeah. Horrible. The dregs of the NFL to get to a Super Bowl? That didn't happen. So, yeah, very, very different. But, yeah, I was a diehard born Broncos fan from, like, birth. I think I went to my first game when I was 3.
Excellent. Yeah. You know, you talked about the, you know, the struggles of a young Bronco franchise. You know, in researching the book, I was completely unaware that the Steelers were horrible.
They were hard luck.
Yeah, until their entire existence. Johnny Carson, no greater cultural icon in the U.S. than Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show. I mean, he dubbed them as the lovable losers. From 1933 through 1971, they were bad, horrible. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, they weren't. You know, and 1972 was the year that they won the division. They turned it around. Most people kind of remember the Immaculate Reception game on December 23rd. And so when we set out to write the book, you know, you can't have a thesis. Tom, the co-author of the book, he's a Yinzer, born and raised in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
You know, and he grew up with them, same age as we are. And, you know, he experienced the pain of the steel industry collapsing. His father lost his job. And while his father was not in the mill, his father was working for a steel company as an engineer, but lost his job through the process. And, you know, it was a very painful deindustrialization transformation that the entire Rust Belt had to undergo.
Sure.
But in Tom's mind, you know, he looks at Pittsburgh now. Pittsburgh, and I use the terminology in the book, you know, I consider Pittsburgh to be one of the most listable cities in the world because it constantly shows up in those lists of, you know, the top 20 cities in the world, the top 20, you know, places to have a career, the top whatever, for cities. And, you know, Pittsburgh has come out of its deindustrialization transformation kind of smelling like a rose. They are world renowned for academics, medical research, healthcare, technology, robotics, and a whole host of other things. Yet you look at some of the Rust Belt cousins like Detroit and Cleveland, you know, that have continued to struggle, you know, with this deindustrialization transformation. And you know, Tom's thesis was, you know, when Pittsburgh needed its heroes, you know, when it was, you know, really, you know, up against the wall and was struggling, you know, they were able to find him in the most unlikely place that you could think of. You know, at that time, the successful team was the Pittsburgh Pirates baseball team.
Sure.
But all of a sudden, here's this, you know, football team, and football has deep roots in Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio. That's where the game was founded professionally.
Absolutely.
You know, and, you know, during those early years, the Steelers, you know, the University of Pittsburgh and Duquesne University, they were powerhouses in the NCAA. And, you know, so in the 70s, to have Pittsburgh, you know, these citizens be able to look at a team that was kind of built in their mirror image, you know, this blue collar, you know, tough as nails, bring your lunch pail to work type of guys. You know, they found those heroes and found the resolve to, you know, stick together and to, you know, and to become a new economy city. So, you know, that was a pretty cool thing about the book. And I guess, you know, what I'm trying to get at is when we you can't talk about this thesis that the Steelers saved Pittsburgh without talking about Pittsburgh. And we can't talk about Pittsburgh without talking about Western Pennsylvania. And that will absolutely bore your sports fan. You know, it's like, I want to read about football. I don't want to read about, you know, sure. These jabronis, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, we kind of had to do it. So we needed to have a fixture point. And we used that Immaculate Reception game in 1972 as kind of a way that we can weave these stories in. And so we can talk a little bit about, you know, 1700 Pittsburgh, 1800 Pittsburgh, and the steel industry formation and the like, but then quickly jump back to the game and how the game, what a fantastic game.
Amazing game.
Not just how it ended, but what an incredible football game. You know, and then, you know, once that game is over, then we can tell the story of the Steelers and progress forward. But we use that kind of inflection point in the Steelers' fortunes from a horrible team to a good football team. Really kind of, you know, digest itself down into that Immaculate Reception game and that unbelievable ending.
Well, and you have said so many things that I want to digest here, because for one, it is absolutely fascinating to think about the idea that that team changing the fortunes of that city. But now that I'm thinking about it, you think of Detroit and the Lions, and you think of the Browns and the what has gone on in Cleveland and even the Bengals. And says, there's one difference. One had a group of heroes, like you said, and that is really, really interesting to think about. The other thing that you said is, you know, we talked about that Immaculate Reception game. People remember the finish. It probably wouldn't get seen on Red Zone all that much. If I remember right, the final was like 13-7, wasn't it?
You know, I don't
I think it was 7-6 until the final.
The final score escapes me, but I think you're right. I think it was 13-7. The Steelers were up, and then, you know, the one play that would have made it on Red Zone was Kenny Stabler.
Right.
Who was a backup quarterback in that game. Scrambles off the left side and sees it nothing but green astroturf in front of him and rumbles, stumbles, bumbles along and gets miraculously Kenny Stabler scored a 30-yard run, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, the Steeler fans are like, well, this game's over. No one, yeah. Defensive struggle. Art Rooney, the owner of the Steelers, missed the Immaculate Reception because he was in the elevator going down to the locker room because he was going to console his players. Like, hey, you gave it the good old try, guys. Missed the entire thing. But yeah, and then it was, you know, fourth down and this play that it continues to be, you know, just a couple of years ago, it was voted the most memorable play in NFL history. Yeah. And that's 50 years old, that play. You know, sure. We had David Tyree's helmet catch. Yeah. We had all these other, you know, fantastic plays, but still, you know, you can look back 50 years ago. There's a play that people consider to be the most memorable play in NFL history.
Okay, I have to ask you, because you don't have the Steeler bias. I have to ask you, should it have counted? Was it a legal play?
Yeah, you know, we spend quite a bit of time in the book. And, you know, we also live very close to the Maddens. John Madden's.
Really?
John Madden's house.
Oh, wow.
A mile up the road.
Oh.
John
was still mad.
Yeah. Well, you know, we spoke to his son.
Okay.
Mike. And Mike actually, you know, reading the accounts of the book, you know, in Raider Nation, it is referred to as the Immaculate Deception.
Deception.
Yes. Sure. And we are right here in the Bay Area in the midst of Raider Nation. And Mike, he actually said, you know, he commented, it's like, you know, you guys have presented this in the most fair way that I think I've seen it. Because we recognize like this.
Yeah.
Incredibly controversial. Did Frenchie Fuqua touch the ball? You know, for younger listeners, you know, back in 1972, if an offensive player touched a forward pass, another offensive player could not touch the forward pass. So it's very important who that ball touched to begin with. Was it Jack Tatum or is it Frenchie Fuqua?
Sure.
You know, and so, you know, who did it touch matters. And then did he actually catch it? Because, you know, we you know, Franco Harris, the image that we have is this super close up that you can't
see. Really see.
Right. You know, and so. You know, there's been a lot of physicists that talk about it, things like that. You know, we quote that in the book. The physicists all, you know, I think one of the physicists that took a look at it is a guy from like the University of Pittsburgh or something like that.
Of course.
He might be Carnegie Mellon, but I don't know if he's completely. But, you know, I tend to think he caught it. And I think it was from Jack Tatum. It bounced off him as well. You know, just the fact that that ball flew about 12 yards backwards, going that way, you know, and Tatum was running into the play, you know, and so, you know, it seemed like that inertia was gone. But, you know, Frenchie Fuqua, he knows, and he loves it when December 23rd comes out, because he plays it pretty coy.
Yes, he does.
Nobody really talks about Frenchie Fuqua except on that day. Every year, and he relishes that attention. So, yeah, I mean, what do you think? You think he caught it? You've seen it a million times.
I think he caught it. Based on the angle that the ball came in, I would think it probably did hit Fuqua. A couple problems with that. One, Fuqua got hit so hard that he has no idea if it hit him or not. He doesn't have. Jack Tatum nailed him. And two, if it happened today, whatever it was ruled is what it would stay. You couldn't overrule it. There is absolutely no angle that you'd say, okay, it's this way or that. However it got ruled, even today, it would stay because there. We can't tell. We can't tell. It's a fascinating story, though, and what an incredible finish. I still think that the most amazing part of it, and I'm sure you've dug into this, is the fact that when it happened, the refs don't do this. The refs kind of go.
Everybody's standing around. You know, the umpire goes over to the this is before instant replay. The umpire goes over to the one of the baseball dugouts. Calls up top where the supervisor of officials is. You know, no one really knows exactly what that conversation was. All of a sudden, it's, you know, we're counting as a touchdown. You know, the Raiders will never forget that play. Yeah. John Madden was, you know, up until the day he died, was, you know, adamant that that they got worked on it. It's strange, the, you know, the umpire of that on that game. Was also the a referee in the Super Bowl with the Cowboys, the second Super Bowl played, the last Cowboys Super Bowl played in the Orange Bowl. He was the guy that kind of got in the way of Cliff Harris tackling Franco Harris on a touchdown run. So the conspiracy theorists are like, hey, that Fred Swearingen guy, man, he's a Steeler homer, but
That is absolutely great. And what an amazing, and like you said, a game that we still look back at. You know, the Raiders and Raider fans have a memory like an elephant. You've got that play. You've got the tuck play. I know here in Denver in the AFC Championship game, you've got the Rob Lytle fumble play. And so the Raiders they've benefited. Don't get me wrong. I remember them, you know, getting a couple calls here and there. I remember one specifically against the Patriots back in the late 70s, I believe, on a phantom roughing the passer call. But they've definitely had their share of lumps. Now, you are going through this book and you are drilling down on the Steelers. And I would be very, very interested to know, between you and your co-author, looking back now, is that the team? That's their favorite. Is that their favorite team? Like, I know for me, the 77 team, even though they didn't win it all, they had, like, my guys were on that team. I love that team. Obviously, the 97 team that wins it all. But I always wonder about Steeler fans because they had a few to choose from. Who is the team that they're like, no, that was our team?
Yeah, I think it's generational. That's a good question. Certainly for people who were, you know, alive back in the day, you know, we have this recency, you know.
Yes, we do.
Thing, you know, it's like, oh, you know, these are the best players ever. Aaron Donald is the greatest defensive tackle ever.
See,
he might be, but if you are constructing a top 10 list of the 10 best professional football players ever, and Mean Joe Green is not in that top 10, you probably need to go back and revisit your list.
You're
right?
Correct.
You know, so we have this recency effect, and you know, some of the younger folks, and you know, think about like, the Steelers have won a Super Bowl both under Bill Cowher and Mike Tomlin. Those teams, you know, there were, since it was four Super Bowls in 6 years, there's a lot of holdover. There are a lot of players with four Super Bowl rings, right?
Yeah.
But they were there for the duration. And I think those are, you know, the favorite teams, you know, and, It's interesting the legacy that those teams have and the Steelers have. I am associated with a lot of Pittsburgh Steeler online communities.
Sure.
And oh my goodness, the whining and moaning that goes on for a team that's currently 7-5, right? You would think the world is ending.
Right.
This has been a couple of years in a row now.
Yeah.
It's like, dudes, Mike Tomlin has never had a losing season as a head
coach. Must be nice.
Isn't this like 17th or 18th year, right?
Yes.
It's like, you don't know how lucky you have it.
No.
Last time your team was 2-14.
Right.
It happens all the time in the NFL. So while they're, I think, you know, even with the recency factor that they haven't won a Super Bowl in about a decade or so, I think those teams would be, you know, Yinzer's, you know, favorites. They'll look back
sure.
at them. Those were some ball players.
Well, and I wonder, even among those fans, you have Terry Bradshaw. You have Ben Roethlisberger. You have Lynn Swann. You have Hines Ward. You have, like, who are the guys? Did they look at the modern play? Hey, they're better now. Because I look at Bradshaw and Roethlisberger, and I'm like, I would love to have seen Roethlisberger in those 70s offenses. I would love to see Bradshaw playing now in these offenses. I just always kind of wonder, is it just based on the age? Is it just the era? Or did they go, no, Bradshaw was the guy. Bradshaw was it. He is the best quarterback in our history.
Yeah, well, I think they, you know, I get the feeling that maybe they think Big Ben might be the best
quarterback. Really?
Which, you know, Bradshaw, while he had tremendous amount of success, remember
yes.
at the beginning of his career, he wasn't that great. And he was,
no.
you know, a lot of people, including a lot of Pittsburgh Steelers fans, thought he was, you know, the country boy from Louisiana is too stupid to play
too
quarterback.
Dumb. Yeah.
So, you know, keep in mind, though, Terry Bradshaw called his own plays on the field, right?
You're right.
You know, that was back in the era when the quarterback was calling the plays. You know, back in the early 70s, if you completed 50% of your passes, that was really pretty good. That was the benchmark because defense was played differently. You know, the illegal contact rule came in about, you know, when it came about in the 70s, it was called the Mel Blount rule.
Yeah.
It was all number 47 would molest the receiver from the
beating people up.
Snap. Yeah. And so he would constantly be pushing, shoving, you know, affecting these routes. So, you know, we're familiar now with quarterbacks throwing receivers open, like with a back, you know, back shoulder fade pattern or something like that. But we also know that they throw to a spot. You know, Peyton Manning was great at that. He knew where every player was going to be when he's under pressure. Throw it to a spot because I know my guy's going to be there to at least fight for the ball. It's not going to be incompletion or interception. My guy's going to be there to at least be there. Back in 1972, that wasn't the case. If you could not see your receiver, you couldn't throw the ball because you have no idea where he's going to be because, you know, a cornerback or safety's been pushing, shoving them, hitting them, you know, constantly until the ball gets up there to be pass interference.
Right.
Linemen back in the 70s couldn't use their hands to block. I don't know if you ever remember
right.
the old electric football games or maybe even looking at some old playing cards. You know, they've got their fists like up to their sternum and their hands up. That's how they block.
Right.
You know, and that's not the best blocking technique because
it really is.
Nobody uses it today, right? Then, you know, you talked about this phantom roughing the passer call that, you know, a team may benefit from.
Sure.
You know, we have nothing the passer calls
right.
today in today's NFL. You know, back in the 70s, Terry Bradshaw calling his own plays. He's got these linemen limited where they block. You've got receivers who are, you know, getting molested to their entire route tree. And at the same time, he is another player that you can hit in the head. You can hit in the knees. You can land on top of them. All these things that you can't do in today's NFL. So, you know, while there might be people looking at Big Ben's number, looking at Roethlisberger and going, well, look at these just passing numbers. They're spectacular.
Sure.
It's like Bradshaw, you know, 2-time Super Bowl MVP, 4-time Super Bowl champion, threw a share of interceptions along the way, but you know, also threw a lot of touchdown passes as well. And he played in a different era where, you know, Tom Brady can't play in the 1970s because there's just no way a quarterback plays into his 40s. George Blanda did, but George Blanda
right.
was a kicker, you know, at the end of his career, not a quarterback. You know, just the amount of punishment that these guys took. You know, look at a guy like Archie Manning, a wonderful football player. I mean, his useful career was about 8-9 years with the Saints.
Right.
You know, before he was just a bloody pulp.
Just got beat up.
That went into retirement. An entirely different game. And it's really fun. You know, I'd encourage listeners to go on YouTube and check out some of these games. You know, just the playing surface alone is different. You know,
so different.
Back in the day, you had AstroTurf, which is really, you know, painted green asphalt. And then you had natural turf. But, you know, I was just thinking earlier today, a couple of years ago, there was a Sunday night football game here in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And we had a bomb cyclone and it was pouring rain. Oh, yeah. And yet throughout that, you know, a game where it rained 5-7 inches or something like that, the playing surface looked like a putting green at Augusta National, right?
Yeah.
Well, in a good weather game in Cleveland Municipal Stadium back in the day, you couldn't read a player's numbers because they're covered in mud, you know, and it's from the playing surface to the pads that people wear, the rules. Another thing I like to look at from, you know, playing players in the 70s, gloves.
Oh,
there ain't a glove on a single player. And you look at a running back like Larry Zonka, that great running back for the Miami Dolphins. There's not even a Band-Aid on him, you know. And if you have not seen Larry Zonka play, go take a look at some of these clips on YouTube. And that guy is the epitome of a man's man,
yep.
A blue-collar player on a tough, rough-and-tumble football team. No elbow pads, no taped-up fingers, no gloves. I think the only players that don't play in gloves now are punters and place kickers.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Everyone wears them.
Everyone wears them. Maybe some quarterbacks don't, or maybe they wear them in one hand.
Yeah, but the fact that some do.
Yeah, and everybody else has got those gloves. And if you haven't been around those gloves, if you press one up against the wall, it sticks for a couple of seconds before it falls down, right? So, you know, these one-handed catches people are making. Yeah, they tend to be making a lot of one-handed catches lately. I think they practice it. I don't know if they
practice it
in the 70s. No. But they also benefit from some pretty sticky gloves too, right? So,
well, and for the people that complained about, you know, the Biletnikoff and the Lester Hayes and the Stickum and that kind of thing, the Stickum had nothing on these gloves, because you would see the only benefit was every once in a while you'd see Lester make an interception off his shin, maybe. But other than that, like to see these guys do what they're doing with the one hand, it is a different. It is definitely an advantage. So I got to ask you. And I want to drill down a little bit on comparing eras, because I'm always fascinated by comparing eras. What do you like more, though? Do you like the older stuff? Do you like the new? Like, I like them both. I think they both have their place. There's a part of me that still likes going back and watching those old ones, though.
Yeah, I'm like you, Clint. I watch a lot of football, and I like the game. I'm not going to look and go, I don't like it. I do not like the way that we cannot tackle the quarterback much more, you know, and I would like to see that change. And I would love to see like a pass interference in the NFL be a college foul, a 15 yards from line of scrimmage. I hate to see a referee, you know, Sunday night, we almost had the Chiefs win a game that they didn't deserve to win.
Right.
Luckily, the referee kind of blew that defensive pass interference call.
Yes, he did.
You know, here you have this, you know, this great game, and then we leave it up to the referee to call like a 40 or 50 yard penalty. It's like, that's a killer. But you know, I do have my pet peeves with I don't understand why or when third and one became a passing down. You know, I don't understand like how you can have a first down, first and 10, gain 6 yards on a running play. Second down, you gain 5 yards in the first down. You get first down again, then you throw the ball. It's like, well, you're running the ball just fine. Yeah. But, you know, when was the last – I don't even know the stat, but, you know, I'm going to look it up as soon as we're done. You know, if an NFL team rushes for 200 yards in a game, what's their one-loss record? And I bet it's pretty good because, you know,
I would think it probably is.
Right now, NFL teams are, you know, most of them don't rush for 80, 90 yards a game.
They don't even care.
And then take it the other way around. If you throw the ball for 400 yards a game, you know, what's your one-loss record then? And granted, there's a lot of times, like if you have a big lead, you might run the ball. And if you're behind, you might throw the ball. But, you know, sometimes we, you know, I think particularly the offensive play coaches, they fall in love with the number of plays they have.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, we want to throw the ball. We got to throw it all over the place. And, you know, sometimes it's, you know, just keep it simple. You know, football is really a territorial game. It's just like rugby. Right. You know, and field position matters, you know, pre-snap penalties matter, turnovers matter. But winning the line of scrimmage, I look at the San Francisco 49ers. They are, in my opinion, the best team in professional football.
Yeah.
They dominate the line of scrimmage on both offensive and defensive line. They've invested over the years so much in their defensive line that they've been able to trade away people like Solomon Thomas. What? I mean, since when does Solomon Thomas become superfluous on any football team except for the 49ers because they have so many defensive linemen. Offensive linemen the same, and they dominate the line of scrimmage, and they are a running football team. They set up all their passes are set up through, you know, primarily play action passes and things like that. And I think, you know, sometimes you particularly see it in college. You know, I think you see these offensive masterminds kind of, you know, they tend to dominate the head coaching hires both in college and in the pros. And I think they kind of fall in love with their playbook, and it's like, hey, let's get more plays for our, and we'll pass, and, you know, kind of these gimmick things that, you know, back when we were younger. You know, those gimmick, you know, run and shoot offenses, air raid offenses, those were ways to, for an inferior team talent wise, to be able to compete. Let's do something weird. So now the way you do that is do by playing option football in college. Yep. You know, it's like we can't compete on the air raids with everybody, but what we can do is we can run the triple option, AKA Army,
Army, Navy, Air Force, Navy,
Air Force, you know, Georgia Tech up until this year. I like them both, but there are some times like I would love to see some. I don't mind lower scores this year in the NFL. I like seeing NFL defenses buck up, and you know we've got this, you know, new bit of you know, I think coaching style on the defense here. It's like, you know what, we're going to play too deep. We're going to make you play in front of us, and if you think you can go 75 yards in 10 plays without turning the ball over, without having a sack, without having a big, you know, holding penalty or something like that. Well, then we're gonna let you score that. But for us, you know, we're not gonna let you beat unless you happen to be playing against Tyreek Hill. We're not gonna let you beat us over the top and get those easy scores. So I don't mind defensive playing. I like both errors, but I would like us to, you know, I would like to see some, you know, tougher play on defense and lower scores is fine with me because I want to watch the game. If it's, remember that Chiefs Rams game on Monday night a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was a great game. But, you know, I've also seen some, you know, I doubt that the Chargers 6-0 game over New England this last weekend, I doubt that was a great game. But I have seen great games that are in the 20s, right? You know, that I don't mind seeing again.
Well, and when you look at what you talked about, as far as teams dominating up front, how many teams, one, like you said, will make that commitment to go get those not sexy players, but beef up that line of scrimmage. And right now I can think of two, and it is probably the Eagles and the Niners that have really truly said, no, we're going to just be good up front and then kind of see how things play out. And they've benefited from that. Now, if you don't have a Patrick Mahomes, if you don't have that, even a Tyreek Hill, then we're going to be really, really good up front. And we're going to kind of see. But when you watch the Niners, like you said, they're beating you with the run game. How many plays, Deebo Samuel, are basically runs? I know he threw it, but it's a running play. We all know it's a running play. They've gone out of their way to be very, very smart with what they do in their offensive scheme. I want to talk a little bit about comparing errors, and we still have some things that we got to get to. But when I look at like the younger kids now, and hey, we were young once.
Yeah.
Seemed like a long time ago, but we were young ones and we said the same thing. We said, oh, you guys don't get it. Johnny Unitas had nothing on the Kenny Stables and Roger Staubach.
Yeah.
And so I understand the youth, right? Yeah. But at the same time, I've reached a point in my life where comparing eras to me is kind of interesting, but also it's kind of pointless, right? Instead, I prefer to look at the guys, the evolution. Mm-hmm. I can look at a Larry Bird and people will say, well, Larry Bird could never be successful in the NBA now. And I go, well, Nikola Jokic is living proof that he can be. He's just a different.
Klay Thompson's living proof.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And when we look at the NFL, I look at guys saying you could never have a player like we see them every day. And so I'm always kind of fascinated to see those kinds of players, even Ben Roethlisberger. And he's not that far back. I mean, isn't he just John Elway? He's just a big, strong, athletic guy, you know? And so I'm always kind of fascinated. No, let's find the modern version, or let's find the version of what he was. Tom Brady, on some level, is probably a little Johnny Unitas. I mean, hey, I'm going to be really accurate. I'm going to be really smart. I'm a fierce competitor, but I'm always kind of interested to find those guys that you go, no, it's the same guy. It's just a different era. That's always more interesting to me than just going, oh, those guys couldn't play today.
Yeah. You know, well, you look at a player like Mel Blount. We've used him as an example a couple times. Yeah. He is still the prototypical NFL cornerback.
Yes, he is.
He's tall, rangy.
Rangy.
Fast.
Yep.
And but you know, one advantage he has, he had a mean streak to him too.
Yes,
he wasn't afraid to tackle. Yeah. You know, sometimes we have, you know, Marcus Peters just got waived a couple of weeks ago, primarily for the fact that he seemed rather disinterested in tackling for the Raiders.
Right.
Right? You know, and he's a great player. He's a wonderful corner, cover corner. Right. But, you know, Mel Blount, he can play anytime.
Yes.
You know, there are, you know, some, I think, you know, differences. You look at like the differences in size, just the size of the human beings. Jack Lambert was this fierce linebacker, right? When he came out of Kent State, he was barely 200 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, he beefed up to 220, you know, which makes him a strong safety.
Strong safety. Yeah.
The day,
yeah.
Which would make him one badass.
Oh, yeah. He'd be bad. He'd be a player.
But, you know, the offensive linemen, you know, they weren't 300 pounds. You know, they were, you know, in the 200s. You know, it's, you know, great players are great players. You know, you look at Johnny Unitas And I do like what you said about, you know, competitors. And I know you have an auto racing background in your family, you know. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of people that don't know about auto racing, you know, it's like the speed freaks aren't successful auto racers. You know, this Tom Cruise, I feel need for speed folks.
No.
They're not the successful auto racers are the ones who want to win. They don't care how fast they're going as long as they're 1 inch closer to the start finish.
I want to beat you.
Right. I want to beat you. And that's, I think that, you know, the common denominator for all these great athletes that play in the NFL. There are so many wonderful athletes that never get it. They never see the field because they just aren't the competitor that, you know, somebody else is. And those are those tiebreakers, right? When you have two athletic freaks, you know, who's the guy that wants it more? Who's the better football player as opposed to the track athlete who's, you know, got a pair of shoulder pads on?
If I gave you in a combine, Jerry Porter, big, strong, could run, or Jerry Rice, you would pick Porter. You'd be insane not to pick Porter. And yet, there's a big difference. One guy might be the best ever, and one guy didn't really care that much about playing, but man, he filled out a uniform. And so when I look at guys like, you talked about Joe Green, and Joe Green to me, Bob Bully is another one. I don't care what era they played in. They were that guy. Muhammad Ali would have been a champion whenever he fought because he was going to beat you. And so, yeah, you bring up some really, really good points. I can sit here and talk about this all day. We've got to move forward because you also have written a book that is very, very personal in nature. And I want to kind of drill down on this book a little bit. Talk about the book that you wrote. It's got a little different feel. This isn't a sports book, is it?
No, it's not a sports book.
Tell me about this.
It's very personal. It's a book called Me, Myself, and My Multiple Myeloma. Multiple myeloma, for those who aren't aware of it, is a blood cancer. It's an incurable blood cancer, but a treatable blood cancer. I was diagnosed with that, 2019, March of 2019. And I've gone through, you know, chemotherapy as part of a stem cell transplant. And I'm in active treatment now. In fact, I had chemotherapy this afternoon. Good news is I'm feeling good, feeling strong. And, but you know, once I was diagnosed, I had the pleasure of, you know, being the, center point of some interviews, in the media and some videos. And, you know, people would see those and reach out to me through social channels and like ask me questions, newly diagnosed patients. And, you know, and so being a resource to them, I thought, you know, maybe I should just write up some blog posts. So, you know, I can do the one to many as opposed to one to one. And then I thought, you know, why don't I just put all these blog posts, you know, into a book idea instead. So that's what I've done. I've put together as my cancer memoir, my journey and fight with the cancer, you know, through diagnosis and through treatment. I'm super excited about it because, you know, I'm donating the proceeds of that book, the writer's proceeds, to the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. So, you know, it's a book intended to be a resource for the community, for patients, patient caregivers and their allies. And hopefully it's about one of those people. It's for that community. And hopefully it's going to benefit the NMRF as, you know, the race to a cure to do advanced treatments for patients. That book, the interior is done. The cover's got to be approved. I'll have books in hand to sell exclusively myself through my channels in January. The ebook will be available at booksellers everywhere in March, which is Multiple Myeloma Month. And then the paperback will be available at bookstores nationwide in July. So really looking forward to that. This book actually has tie-ins to the Immaculate book. And that, you know, I'm a musician as well. And so for years I have thought about, you know, what looks good on the back of a band t-shirt, you know, these little sayings and stuff. And so my mottos are important to me. And when I got diagnosed with multiple myeloma, it really, you know, kind of level set, you know, my mind on some things. And one of them was taking things for granted, you know, people, relationships, and time. Taking time for granted, because I would, you know, Clint's a friend of mine, but I don't need to talk to him today. I'll talk to him tomorrow, maybe next week, whatever. I've got plans for next month, next year, decade from now, whatever. And realize that, you know, we all have uncertain futures. And for me, it took a diagnosis with a cancer to recognize the fact that, you know, hey, maybe you shouldn't take things for granted. And so one of the mottos I adapted was, if not now, when? You know, it's like, one day I'm going to ... Well, that was Tom Olenek's, you know, one day I think I want to write a book about Immaculate, how the Steelers saved Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
He told two decades, he's been talking to his friends about this, his family, and he talked to me about it a bunch of times. And finally, I just looked at him and said, Tom, if not now, when? Yeah. You know, we're not getting younger. Let's start the book. You know, let me start writing. And if I start veering off of your vision, rein me back in. You know, a year and a half later, the book was done. You didn't have to rein us in at all. And we got it done. And so if not now, when is one of my sayings. Another one, punch today in the face. So, you know, the whole idea of, you know, use today up. As you're laying in bed at night, you know, you kind of look over toward tomorrow's direction and say, I'm coming for you next.
Yeah.
And make the most of our time on this great planet we have. But thank you so much for mentioning that book. I know you got a sports show and all of a sudden we're talking about a cancer memoir, but I do appreciate it. Thank you.
I am always kind of fascinated because my background in sports, obviously, you know, with my dad and that kind of thing, but I was a coach. I was a high school basketball coach for a number of years. And you're dealing not just with teaching the game, you're dealing with teaching kids life lessons, because that's what's going to stick. Let's be honest, the best of them are going to play what, 10 years, and then they're going to be done. But those kind of lessons that you're talking about, those kind of things that you're talking about, and sometimes you can get in that mode of you know, why did this happen to me, why does it have to be me? And the older I get and seeing some of the kids that I've coached now become adults, and then they're going through their own trials, they're going through their own situations, I am more and more convinced that people that go through something like this, and I say this directly to you, were probably chosen because you're going to be the person that helps that next person. And I know that in my life, my mom went through cancer. I had a very close friend go through cancer. And to see the kind of shepherding that goes on, hey, I know what's going to happen. Here's what's coming next. I'm convinced that this is why so many people deal with these things, because they are the ones that are going to help that next round of people get through these things. So very, very personal book that you have there. But I absolutely love the message that you have. And I love the message that you're talking about. How are you going to use this to go forward? Not use this to say, oh, you know, this is tough, and this is as hard as it is. There are so many logistically going through what you're going through. Forget the physical, the emotional, the logistically, it's a ton. The fact that you've written this book, I think is very, very commendable, and I wish you nothing but the best on this book. Really, really good message there, though.
Yeah. And, I want to give back to community. I feel great right now. I can tell you that everything I've learned about cancer, well, not everything, but darn near all of it has come from my support group. People have been there before me. Right. And right now I feel great. And I want to be the one that can reach back and pull somebody forward when they need a little bit of help. Cause I know there's going to be days, when I'm going to need someone to reach back and pull me forward, right?
You know, so we all do.
We are all in this together. We all get something.
Yes.
Right. So
nobody's living forever.
Yeah. What can I do to help my community, to help others? And because I know it's going to come around when I need help, and people have helped me already. I mean, just you know, the amount that you learn. And you are right. You know, when you talk about logistics, you know, one of the things I tell people is, if you know somebody, anybody's going through a serious chronic health illness, particularly if they're alone, reach out to them, because we are inundated with snail mail alone. Forget email, But we get stuff in the mail every day, and there's doctor's appointments, there's medications, there's in our U.S. Health system, there's payers, providers, pharmaceutical companies. Everybody needs something. It is mind-boggling how much correspondence that there is.
Yep.
I can't imagine doing this alone. I'm lucky enough to be married to a wonderful woman, Lori. We'll be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary coming up here next
week.
And, you know, she helps me with that stuff because I've never had a brain for it. And I would hate to do it by myself.
So you literally need a secretary for the amount of, it is unbelievable, the time and the money alone. Like I said, forget all the other is unbelievable. Well, that's absolutely great. And we got to make sure that we get those links out to listeners. You've got another project in the works, though, that I want to touch on. You have a project that you're working at that is something that is near and dear to me. You've got a book that you are working on and is a completely different subject. It's in the world of sports, but it's a completely different subject. What else do you have going here? Ray, you got a lot on your plate here. What else you got going?
I do. I'm excited about this book. The working title is The Indy 500, A Daily Diary of the Greatest Spectacle in Racing. Okay. When I was a kid, I was going through a Scholastic America catalog that a teacher had given me, given our class, and I saw this book. It was the Indy 500, 30 Days in May. It was a day-by-day chronicle of the preparation for the 1970 Indianapolis 500, and then it culminates with the race. Now, this is back in the day. Back in the day, I hope your listeners aren't too tired of me saying this, but this is back in the day when the Indianapolis 500 was a month-long event.
Yes.
You know, there was 2 weekends of qualifying, 4 days, 2 weeks of practice before the first one, then another week of practice. So you'd have 3 weeks getting qualifying for the race, trying to find the speed to qualify for the race. Then a week off until Thursday before the race and get one last chance to fine tune your car. But it was just trying to find the speed, and it was also a instance where you'd have a lot more cars entered into the race than to qualify in the race. So the drama and all the different stories that kind of came through. And when I read that book, I was just so blown away. And as we were talking earlier, Clint, back in the 70s, auto racing was flat out dangerous.
Yeah, it was.
People were getting injured and killed on a regular basis. Walking away from a crash just didn't really happen. I mean, you were carried away, and sometimes you were buried away.
And not the little tracks. You're talking about Indy, at Indy. I mean, at the big tracks, big names. Yeah, yeah. You're right.
It was the biggest of big names. If you're a Formula One fan, you've got some of the greatest drivers that ever lived, like Jim Clark. Jim Clark died in an accident in a car. Of course, Ayrton Senna died 30 some odd years ago, one of the greatest racers ever. That book captivated my imagination. I became a fan of the Indy 500. For me, it was the pleasure of my father, being stationed at Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis when I was a teenager. So I got to go to the track for the first time and see it. I've been a ticket holder since. I've been to so many races. It's some people get it and some people don't.
You're right.
It's a bunch of left turns. And you're right. But just the race itself. Chasing the racetrack. Your car changes its characteristics as the fuel load moves and as tire wear comes about. The track changes. The temperature changes. And the sun shines on it. The amount of rubber gets laid down to it. But when you run this development exercise and this this changing of the car, you run that back the entire month as you're trying to get speed, qualify, and do all that. Then it comes down to the race. Once you really begin to understand the sport and the event, you recognize that, the glory's all done for the driver. And, at the very end of the race, there's a lot of miles, literally, to get to that checkered flag.
A ton.
There's a lot of things to do. And so, I just set out this year. I guess it was this year. I was thinking, I want to pay homage to that book by updating it, writing it again for this year, for this next race. So that's the approach we're taking. Kind of a daily diary. There's not a lot of stuff that happens like at this point in time. So during the fall and all, we'll be skipping forward, days. But then when things really gear up for some teams that all they do is race Indianapolis, we'll be exploring that. And then the cool stuff, you're at Chip Ganassi Racing, you'll have five cars entered in Indianapolis 500 this year. You know, I'm looking forward to speaking to the person who has to arrange all that, right?
Sure.
We need hotel rooms. We need crew members for five cars. How are we going to get everybody there? Where are they going to stay? How are we going to feed them? Things like that. That alone is a story. You know,
that's
half a chapter that, you know, I'm fascinated about. You never hear about the logistics and scheduling management.
Right.
That's racing. But, you know, it's like, you know, what's that old saying? You know, the key to an army is, you know, their supply chain and feeding them. I guess that's the same type of thing for an auto racing team, right? You know, it's where are they going to stay and how are we going to feed them?
Well, and it's always fascinating to me with a race, especially like Indy, because it is such a marathon, obviously. But there were always guys that were great at Indy. And I always thought it's not a coincidence that Al Sr. was so good. It's not a coincidence that even at AJ or obviously Castro Neves now, but Rick Mears understood how to make those subtle adjustments. And by the end, he was so, so good. And you talked about some sports fans, they don't get it. And you're right. But I always thought when you look at it from that perspective, it's not just whose car's faster. That's way too simple. It is the guy that can make those quarter adjustments and those timeout adjustments and those halftime adjustments. Those are the guys in a race like that are really, really good. Those are the guys that ended up winning it.
Yeah, and that experience level and that ability to communicate. So, like, correct. If you're a driver and I'm your crew chief and you tell, like, you know enough to tell me and communicate to me that your car has got a bit of understeer and you might need, like, another quarter turn of front wing.
Yep.
You know, that's a lot better than having somebody that's like, the car won't turn. It's like, oh, okay, we'll throw
it'll be a long day.
If it sticks, right? You know, so, I tell people all the time, you know, I had somebody when I was on the book tour for Immaculate talking about the Indy 500. He's like, tell me why I should go. And I said, well, one, you should go. Just like you should go to try to go to a Super Bowl, try to go to the Derby, do whatever. You know, just go and just soak it in.
Yeah.
I mean, just the stimuli of all your senses going unbelievably loud and the colors and the speed, the sights, the sounds, the taste, everything. You, even if you're a super skeptic about auto racing, you owe it to yourself to go and experience it and think, you know, watching on TV is the best way of seeing it because then you can see a lot of stuff. You could go to a track, you know, they go by, but you should definitely go to the track, see what a car at speed is like when it goes by you in any form of motorsports. I love, as a kid, I used to love going to see, like, you know, sprint midgets racing on cement or dirt.
Oh, but yeah.
That's a good Friday night out right there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Well, and I think people, you know, they talk about it being the greatest spectacle in racing. It's probably the greatest spectacle in sports because people don't grasp the size of the Indy 500. It has its own zip code. It has its own golf course. It has its own museum in the middle of the track. It is its own literal city. I don't know that people truly grasp the size of it.
Yeah. I mean, there's some... You know, in the 70s and 80s, they were getting, you know, over 400,000 people there. Bigger, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway would be bigger than the city of Cincinnati on race day. And so you're like, well, that, Cincinnati seems like a pretty big town. I don't know how many people are there, but
probably
a pretty big town. Yeah, the amount of space and, you know, it's massive. So many people go to it.
Yeah.
It's the largest single-day sporting event in the world. It's kind of magical to go there. And, you know, like I said, you either get it or you won't get it, but definitely go give it a shot. It's fun.
I've got to ask you one last question here. Talking about this and you understand racing and you understand the kind of drop that we've seen at Indy from a national, I guess, interest level. I thought a lot of people started to, well, we'll watch NASCAR. We'll watch the NFL. We'll watch these other things. I believe with Penske buying Indy and taking that over, I just have a feeling he's a smart guy. He's going to bring it back a little bit, isn't he? It's going to get better, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it is getting better. They have 27 cars ran in the series last year, which is fabulous, right?
Yes.
Tony George, in my opinion, ruined the championship auto racing teams, the kart era. Going up before, you know, he split off, he wanted to have more American racers and he wanted to do it on ovals, you know, and auto racing is, You know, it doesn't matter what country you're from. What matters is your bank account, right?
Yeah.
You know, the old saying in auto racing is, you know, how fast do you want to go? How much do you want to spend?
Right.
And, you know, so sponsorship money goes. And, you know, if you're an American driver with no money, and a Brazilian has a bunch of money, the Brazilian's going to get the ride and they're going to be able to go faster. It's just sure. The way it goes.
Yep.
And then ovals are expensive.
Very.
When things go bad on an oval, you end up, you know, smashing into a concrete wall. When things go bad on a road, on a natural terrain road course, yeah. You know, you've got some gravel to clean out of the cockpit or something like right. that. So, you know, when he split it off, in my opinion, you know, CART before the split was some of the best racing in the world.
Doing really well. Yep.
Better than Formula One. Super competitive. Everybody had a chance.
Yes.
And it's taken him a long time, IndyCar, to come back. You know, now there's just one organization. Penske does own it. It's called IndyCar. I think one of the things that they need to do is get it back into the developmental stage. You know, right now there's one car. And the only real engineering you can do on it is shocks and dampers.
Yes.
Which is important, but that's all you could do. Back in the day, you know, you'd have three different chassis manufacturers. Sometimes yep. You have people in their garage.
Right.
You also have multiple engines that you could put into things. You know, now we have two engines, a Honda engine and a Chevy engine. And, you know, you choose one of those two and you put it sure. all in the same car. So it's great racing as far as the competition. But,
right.
you know, I think the thing that captures our imagination sometimes is also the development. Is the,
yes, the ingenuity.
That, yeah. And you built this own car. It's got something unique in it. And, you know, you try to get that, you know, unfair competitive advantage, right? By having something nobody else did, but you, sure. you thought of it.
Yes.
I think that's one of the things that's missing. That's one of the things I think people like about, you know, Formula One. And then, you know, hopefully IndyCar can learn that, you know, Formula One's got that, you know, Drive to Survive show on Netflix that get people behind the scenes.
Yes.
But, you know, I grew up, I'm a knuckler. You know what a knuckler is. Knuckler is, you know, hanging on that chain link fence with your knuckles.
100%.
And that's what all the, you know, the drivers, all the race teams go, oh, look at the knucklers on the fence. It's very difficult to get like good access at any auto racing. You know, Formula One, if it's not the Drive for Survive show, I've been to I went to Montreal this year for Formula One race.
Okay.
And I've been to Monza. You can't get anywhere in a Formula One race. That is a very prestigious opportunity. So, you know, taking you behind the scenes in that show is great. But I would love to see IndyCar and I'd love to see NASCAR does it a little bit, but do what the NHRA does in drag racing, where every ticket is a paddock.
Yes,
you can walk right up to your heroes, lean over the rope, and talk to them as they're rebuilding an engine. The driver's right there. Everybody's got like the A ticket, right? NHRA does fantastic. It's a great fan experience. I think all sports could benefit from that. You know,
I agree.
That's why do you have to spend $1,000 on a ticket to be able to take a peek at Steph Curry walking out of the locker room or whatever.
See.
Picking some stuff up. Right.
Ray, I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I would like to do this again sometime. We have to make sure that we keep this relationship intact. But before we go any further, tell me, where can listeners find your work? Is there a website? Is there a specific place they need to go? Where is the best place to find your work?
Thank you for asking. You can for the book, for the Immaculate book, you can go to any bookseller site.
Okay.
It's available nationwide. You can also go to our website if you want to get a signed copy. That is SteelersSavedPittsburgh.com.
Okay.
If you order from us, we'll give you free shipping. So we're competitive-ish to Amazon, maybe a dollar more. But leave a note if you want to inscribe to anybody in particular, if it's a gift or what have you. Do that. Myself, and my multiple myeloma book is available for pre-order right now at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and some other national booksellers. That will be available through me at rayharching.com in January. So I'll have a couple of months of exclusive sales before the ebook comes out everywhere in March, and the paper in July. And then the 500 book, that hasn't been sold yet. I'm hoping Morgan James bites on it, but unless they listen to this podcast, they don't even know I'm working on it yet. So, but I'll be pitching it to them shortly. And if they bite, great. If they don't, hopefully somebody else will. And that will be out. I'm trying to working hard to get that up by, maybe this time next year. Publishing books is difficult. I didn't know it was an 8 to 18 month process.
Oh, wow.
We learned a lot with Immaculate,
but
we don't want to speed this up, and the book sort of writes itself and will be done by the end of May.
Okay.
Well, it'll take me a little while to finish writing it, but definitely by June. It should be done. So hopefully it'll be out holiday season next year.
Sounds excellent. Hey, you know you are going to need some late holiday gifts. You can go pick up the Steeler book. You know you might even want to start plan going into the new year, maybe some resolutions. There's a really good book there for you. But Ray, I want to thank you so much for stopping by the Daily Dose. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, this has been my pleasure, Clint. Thank you so much for having me on the Daily Dose show. And you know, you need to have me back sometime because I think you and I can have a great conversation about load management in the NBA.
I agree. I agree 100%. We're looking forward to that. Let's make that happen.
Very well. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, next week on The Dose, you know, I hate to bring this up. It's sneaking up on us. But next week will be our last show before Christmas. So we just might have to let Santa Claus know a few things that we are wishing for this year in the world of sports. Plus, we might start to take a look forward to some of the more interesting college football bowl games. So be sure you stop by the Daily Dose and be sure you let a friend know to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you so much to Ray Hartgen for stopping by and spending some time with us here at the Daily Dose. I really enjoyed our conversation. And hey, if you are looking for a last minute gift for an NFL fan, I don't know, you might want to make sure you stop by rayhartgen.com and pick up a copy of Immaculate. Plus, you know he has some more things coming, so be sure you check back over there going forward. Hey, I also want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to the Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.